Here we go.
Welcome to BP WrigleyCast, the Cubs podcast that looks at the game from the analytical and the fans' point of view. It's good to be back after missing last week, and I'm very glad to be back because we have a special guest today, Julie DeCaro. She is the update anchor at 670 The Score and a writer at The Cauldron. So she also hates red peppers, I just found out. So yeah. Julie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start with Ryan filled me in on an opinion you have on Jason Hayward and how he plays defense and how he might be able to alter his current approach. So
it is not about how he plays defense. It was how he played on one single play.
Should he start playing worse defense, Julie?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, and then people started saying on Twitter, like, oh, Chris Bryant hit a home run. I wish he would have saved it for the postseason. Like, my only point was, when you're in a strange ballpark with your back to the infield and you don't know how close to the wall you are, and it's May, maybe you don't have to dive, you know, and risk, like, separating your shoulder. And that was apparently a radical concept for, like, most people.
So you were talking specifically on the play he got hurt.
Yeah, I was talking specifically on that play. I just thought, you know, dude, it's okay. Just dial it down a little bit. I'm not saying let everything drop or, you know, stop playing the way he plays. He's an incredible elite right fielder. He's probably the best in the game at this point. I don't think there's anyone else that could have made that catch. But I just thought it was a little reckless for this early in the season. And, I mean, you know, and then this idea that, you know, everyone started screaming about, you know, if you don't play 110% all the time, then I don't want you on my team. Well, I don't think that players do play necessarily 110% all the time. I mean, we see guys making value judgments all the time. When the Nationals were at Wrigley, Bryce Harper said, I'm not running into that wall, you know, to make a play. And, you know, and there's been plenty of players who have said that they wish they had made better decisions when they were playing so they wouldn't have been hurt as often. And Ken Griffey Jr. is one of those guys saying that maybe he shouldn't have been so reckless early on. And, you know, it's a long season, and I just think, you know, if you don't know where you are, if you don't know where the wall is, maybe diving head first backwards with your back to the infield isn't the best thing to do in May when it doesn't really count for that much. And, you know, people just went bananas over that. I didn't think it was that radical of a thing to say.
I agree with you on that, actually, with a few small caveats, but I'll clarify and clear my name. I was sharing that with Carlos because I thought it would be an interesting thing to talk about and be able to talk to you about in more than 140 characters. My opinion is basically the same. The only thing I wonder about is, you know, a lot of players talk about and kind of an inability in the moment for them to change the way they play, or, you know, if a guy's just been used to going hard all the time and that's just who he is, going after the ball, you know, in the split second, a lot of them will say, you know, that I can't make that decision just to alligator arm it or, you know, start thinking about the wall. What's your thought on that? Do you buy into that there's just some guys that just can't turn it off?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. I think that, you know, but I do think that players make this assessment all the time. I mean, we see guys pull up at the warning track and not, you know, not know where the wall is and be reaching out with their hands and sort of pulling up a little bit. We see guys making the decision not to dive into the stands or not dive in foul territory when they're close to the wall. So I think they make those decisions all the time. And, you know, we've had Theo Epstein on 670 a bunch of times recently, and he's been talking about, you know, preventing injuries as sort of the new hot analytic that he really wants to look into, and, you know, talked about durability points and all those kinds of things. And I just think that, you know, healthy teams are teams that win championships. I don't want to lose, you know, it's lucky that we're only losing Jason Hayward 3 to 5 days. I don't want to lose him for 3 months. And that's sort of what I was thinking. You know, if you want to make that dive in September when it's, you know, when something's on the line, that's fine. I just didn't, you know, when I was watching him run towards the wall and you could tell he was getting ready to lay out, I was just like, let it drop at the TV. And I just don't want to see someone get hurt. And, you know, I think that that's something that managers and GMs are increasingly asking players to think about. They might not say, don't play 110%, but they'll say, hey, be smart out there. Be smart. You know, don't get hurt. You know, it's May. It's early. So, you know, like I said, I really did not expect for it to blow up the way it did, and I certainly didn't expect some of the people to double down on it like it was the most ridiculous thing they'd ever heard in the world. But, you know, it's Twitter.
Yeah, well, and also I think with every kind of new idea, and, I mean, if Theo Epstein's talking about it like it's the new inefficiency, it makes sense that a lot of people are kind of counter to it, initially,
right?
Just because it's not the way they've been. Baseball's been ingrained in their head. It's always been everybody goes hard all the time. You're always, playing every play like it's the seventh game of the World Series, and it makes total sense that, why would you play every play like it's the seventh game of the World Series? If the Cubs are up 20 games in the division in September, I wouldn't want to see Jason Hayward running into the bricks in Wrigley Field. I mean,
it harkened me back to those Aramis Ramirez days where people wanted him to run as hard as he could to first base, even if it meant pulling an Achilles, just because they were mad they felt like he didn't do it every single time. And I used to sit there and think, this is so stupid. There's no way he's going to beat that ball out. And yet you still want him to risk injury by going absolutely as hard as he can every single time. To me, it's almost like a football mentality, It's like football versus like soccer, I feel like as a kid growing up playing soccer, the coaches, a lot of them are European or South American, and they had a very different attitude towards injuries and taking care of your body and stuff than I saw when my kids started playing football, and I was kind of like shocked by the way that it was like, rub some dirt on it and get back out there. And so maybe it's just a difference in the way that I was brought up, but I just feel like it's such a long season, and the guys that can play 150 games are so few and far between the guys that can do that without injury. And, Hayward, I definitely don't want to see him missing time because he's struggled already, and I think he needs to just get in there and get some kind of repetition. So that was all I was trying to say was, hey, maybe just, dial it down a notch, Jason. It's May. It's a long season. Let's just not dive headfirst into the wall.
I think it's a great point, and I think especially with Jason Hayward, I wonder even if he was trying to, even if at some point in his career he would have those controls to say, hey, be careful, it's early, it doesn't matter. With the struggles he's going through, if he could even turn that off, to be like, this is him contributing, this is how he's able to contribute right now, so let's, dive, make that diving catch and impress and contribute to the team somehow, since his offense has just been so lacking.
Yeah, I mean, I think, definitely part of it. I think that he, probably feels pressure to live up to his contract. And, like I said, there's maybe one or two guys in the whole league that could even make that play, and he's one of them. So, I know that, that there's been a lot of talk about players not going after balls when they know they can't make the play. But I think it's a little bit different for him because he can make those plays that other people can't make. So I don't know when he turns it off. I just want him to be careful. I'd like to see him for, the whole season.
Yeah, hey, Julie, I'm wondering, you probably are closer to this team than we are, so I'm wondering your take. We've heard a lot about the chemistry of this team and how much they get along and how everyone seems to like each other so much, and we see the videos and such, but I'm wondering how important you think that is. I mean, Phil Jackson is one of the greatest coaches in NBA history, but he had a lot of talent. I mean, this team has a lot of talent, so is the chemistry really necessary, or is that just a nice thing to have when you've got guys like Rizzo and Bryant and Russell and Hayward? You've got such amazing talent. What's your take on that?
I think that, it was really funny because during the offseason, when people were talking about the Cubs courting Hayward and people were saying that he was telling them this is a low-pressure situation, and a lot of us immediately said, that's ridiculous. This is, the Cubs haven't won for 100 years. This is a super high-pressure situation. How can you say that? But, the more I thought about it, the more I started thinking about the idea that you do have Rizzo and you've got Bryant and you've got, we had Schwarber at the time and all these other guys. And by the way, I hate it when people say we when they're talking about teams, and I don't know why I keep doing it tonight.
We'll give it a pass.
I make fun of
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. It's been a long weekend. I'm really tired. He doesn't have to be the guy. He can just be one of the guys. And I think that that's one of the things that Joe Maddon does really well with this team, is that there is a lot of pressure on this team. They've been picked to win the World Series. They've already been on the cover of SI twice. They've got, people watching their every move, and they seem pretty oblivious to it. And I think part of the reason they seem so oblivious to it is that he's created this sort of fun little clubhouse world where, all they do is play around and have fun, and yeah, there's serious times too when they get ready for games and stuff, but for the most part, they don't seem bothered by this, and I think that a lot of that is sort of due to the environment that Joe creates. So, I think it is fun. It's a long season, like I keep saying, and, it's a grind. It's a daily grind, day after day after day, to go out there, especially when you're not hitting or the team's not playing well. And so anything you can do to inject levity into it and take some of that pressure off, I think, is really important. And I think that's what Maddon has sort of created with all these little games and the videos and the vines and, all the kind of silly stuff that we see going on all the time.
Yeah, I mean, what I come back to a lot of times when I think about coaches and managers, I think about, like, are they smart? I mean, I remember hearing Phil Jackson talk, and I'm like, that's a smart guy. And I remember when the Bulls hired Vinny Del Negro, and I heard that his press conference, and after 45 seconds, I'm like, that's a dumb guy. He's dumb. He's not a smart guy. And Joe Mendez obviously a smart guy, and he's put a lot of thought. I mean, you know, pulling up in the you know, the van where he's dressed up and Dave Martinez has the bong in his hand. I mean, that's funny stuff. But I think he's like, he's taking pressure off them. And he's helping them see it as just, it's just a game. You know, don't put so much thought into it, so much pressure on it. And after the game, they have, you know, 30 minutes of dancing if they win, and then they let it go. And if they lose, it's 30 minutes of just, like, you know, thinking about it and then moving on. And so I think that there's a lot of thought that goes into that. So that, to me, that's the best thing about Madden, is just that you've got such a cerebral guy, and everything that he does, there's a lot of thought behind it. So it's really encouraging for me to see someone who's so smart just doing, you know, things that seem kind of silly, but you know that there's a lot of thought behind it.
Yeah, and Joe sort of just has this aura when he walks in the room. It's just very, he's just sort of, you know, he's very chill and he's very zen, and he sort of gives this off, this aura of like, everything's gonna be fine. You know, mm-hmm. like whatever it is, nothing bad's gonna happen. Everything's gonna be good. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that is, I think it's a rare person who sort of is able to sort of put other people at ease that way. And I think that that is one of his greatest talents, in addition to being really smart, is this ability he just has to sort of be like, that's okay, everything's fine. And I think that really matters, especially when you have a team full of really young guys like this and guys who don't have a ton of experience. You know, his ability to put them at ease, I think, counts for a lot. I'm not sure that he gets enough credit for that.
Julie, I wanted to kind of take it away from specifically the Cubs for a second and talk about you. You took kind of an interesting route to where you are in your career, and I want to say you worked in kind of more, we'll call it alternative media, kind of like we do, on the internet, you know, not necessarily like a newspaper writer.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about just, you know, what it was like, how hard it was to get to where you are, and just in general, what you found that you thought is most difficult about kind of the day-to-day life of somebody covering a team or sports?
Yeah, I think it was really different. In fact, I've been sort of marveling lately at how different it is from when I started blogging. So I started over at Bleed Cubby Blue way back in like 2006, when there were, you know, there weren't that many Cubs blogs out there at the time. That was a huge one. And I started sort of cultivating a following when, I don't even know if you can still do this at SB Nation, but you used to be able to write your own posts there, you know, just followers mm-hmm. could write their own posts. So I started doing that and sort of cultivated a following that way, and then started my own site in 2007. And back then, we really were the black sheep of, you know, I mean, the Cubs didn't want anything to do with us. There was no way we were getting credentials for anything. They, you know, if you said anything bad about it, they knew it immediately. Or if you said anything bad about the team, they knew it immediately. One time I photoshopped pigs' heads onto all the bullpen players and started calling it the pig pen. They knew about that. I don't think Crane's forgiven me for that still. But it was, you know, it was a different world. I mean, like I said, you know, bloggers have gotten so much more validity to them now in the eyes of the team than we ever had. So that was always tough. You know, if you were trying to write something about the game, you basically had to turn on CSN and watch the post-game press conference and, you know, do it remotely like that, because there was no way that we were getting any kind of access to anybody. So it's really different. And so, you know, from there, I was doing law at the same time, and so I, you know, every day, whether I was sick or, you know, whether I went to work or not, I was always working on the blog. I know you guys are all like that too, that it's you know, keeping up with the writing and Twitter and stuff is really important. And I think it's one of those things that it was a hobby for me, but eventually it sort of turned into a career, because I just kept getting these opportunities, like the opportunity to take my blog to the Chicago Tribune when they started Chicago Now, the opportunity to go work at the game when they first launched that at WGN Radio, and then parlay that into, you know, working at the Score. It was really different. It was a much more circuitous route. I think that there's so many more options now. You know, back then it was basically blogging. And you had to try to get noticed that way. But, you know, now if you want to work in radio, you do a podcast. If you want to work in video, you can have a YouTube channel. If you want to write, you can have a blog, and you can get a much bigger audience because of social media. So it's much different, and I think in a lot of ways, we're going to see a lot more people making the transition from, like, you know, what Ryan called alternative media. Was it Ryan? I think it was Ryan. Yeah. Yeah. Alternative media to... you know, to making it into, like, traditional media, because there's just so many more back doors to getting in. It's not the way that it used to be, where you have to, you know, go work at a local high school, you go work at a local paper and cover high school sports and sort of work your way up. You can sort of jump in at a much higher level if you can get a decent following, and if you do good work, and if your work gets seen by the right people. So I always tell, you know, when I go around and talk to colleges and stuff, I always tell kids today, don't be discouraged. There's so many more ways for you to get attention for your work than there've ever been before.
That's an interesting point, and I was curious, what do you think caused that shift that made those quote unquote alternative mediums more accepted, and the fact that teams are, you know, pretty close to some of these mediums now? Is it just the way that digital marketing has gone overall, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it just took them a while to realize that there were a lot of people reading this stuff. Like, you know, I remember having a meeting with the Cubs at one point, with someone from the Cubs who shall remain nameless, and talking to them about how many readers I had, and he was shocked when I showed him my monthly numbers. They just had no idea that there were this many fans involved in reading these blogs. And then they finally figured out how to leverage Twitter and how to use Facebook, and so it's sort of the way that digital marketing has gone for everybody. But it always seems like baseball is the last people to embrace this kind of stuff. It definitely took them a long time to sort of warm up to bloggers and warm up to social media. And when I see, you know, stuff like people like bloggers being upset that they didn't get a credential for this or credential for that, I just have to laugh, because, you know, back when I was blogging, there was just no chance that you were getting anything. And if you asked, I mean, they would have laughed you out of the building. So, I think it's great. And I think that there are so many people out there doing good work who, you know, aren't in traditional media, but are doing, or are obviously just as talented as the people who have those jobs. And sort of, I think there's a big shift happening now, because I feel like media everywhere is getting younger. There's still a lot of these older guys sort of hanging on with, like, grim death to their positions, but they're going to be out soon, and I think that there's going to be a lot more, like, a much younger, much more diverse digital coverage of these sports than we've seen even to date.
Yeah, I really agree with that, and I see a lot of what you're talking about, and it makes me excited about where it's going. I talked to you about these kinds of things before, but being credentialed to go to the Cubs convention and talk to some of the players, and I got credentialed to go into the Brewers clubhouse in Arizona and interview a bunch of the players. I mean, it's really changing for alternative media, and I think that's very indicative of where it's going to be, you know, now that even baseball is starting to embrace it a little bit. What do you think about teams that just don't embrace that? I mean, I'm trying to collect my thought on this one. Do you think that there's been a shift with the Cubs specifically about that kind of stuff? I mean, I've heard things about how Tom Ricketts is a little bit more friendly to that, but have you seen that specifically there, that they're kind of moving that way, that they're, you know, trying to embrace that specifically?
Yeah, I definitely. I remember talking with someone years ago about Cubs social media and saying, you know, you guys could be funny and you could, like, make fun of the team without it being, like, you know, insulting to the team. And, you know, you can, you know, at that time, you know, the Cubs just really were bad. And we're like, you know, you can, you know, just try to talk, telling them about, you know, spicing up their social media a little bit, about their Twitter account, about making it, you know, sort of hipper and funnier and, you know, stuff like that. And I was sort of roundly shut down on that point. But, you know, at the time they would, like, post the lineup and they'd post, like, you know, what time the game was going to start and who the pitchers were. And, like, you know, that was basically it. And the rest of it was, like, you know, talking to, you know, fans who were asking questions and stuff. But there was nothing like there is now. I think they've got one of the best Twitter accounts going in any sport. You know, I put them up there with sort of, like, Portland and Toronto and a couple of, you know, the great NBA sites. But I've definitely seen a huge shift in the Cubs in that area. And I hope it continues. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think that once you come from that era, you come from that area of, like, blogging and alternative media, that's sort of where you always feel like you belong. I never felt like more of an imposter than when I was at the media session with the Cubs, at Cubs convention, and everybody, like, just was looking at me like I had three heads, and people were like, didn't you, like, used to be a blogger? And I was like, yeah. And I'm proud to have been a blogger, and I'm proud of, you know, having come up through Cubs Twitter, and I will never pretend that I came from anywhere else. So when, you know, I've had people say to me, people in the industry say, you know, you can't be on Twitter during the games, like, cheering for the Cubs. Like, you shouldn't do that because you're a journalist. And I've sort of thought about it, because when I'm in the update studio, I'm sort of a straight-up journalist, and the rest of the time I think of myself sort of more of as a columnist and a commentator. And I think that's one of the things that's really changing in the industry is that we're being asked to do different jobs. You know, it used to be like you had your straight-up update anchors, you had your columnists, you had your reporters, you had your beat reporters, and that's all changing because the industry shrunk so much. So it's kind of a fine line to walk for a lot of us, you know. But I think that you're starting to see more and more people in journalism who are, you know, pretty open about who their allegiance is with. Everybody knows that Will Leach is a Cardinals fan. Everyone knows Michelle Beadle's a Spurs fan. Everyone knows Linda Cohn's a Rangers fan. So, you know, I think that a lot of things are changing. I think it's the way the teams react to the to media is changing, and I think that the way media is having to react to the teams is changing too.
Hey, Julie, you know, I'm wondering, when you talked about kind of old school guys, and, you know, I heard today, not to call him out, but Bruce Levine was talking today about numbers, and he was saying that he just didn't think that you could predict what a player was going to do from season to season based on his statistics. And I was, like, literally screaming at my radio, you know, and I was – so do you think that, you know, as – maybe the mean age in the press box gets a little younger, that we're going to see a growing acceptance of analytics?
I would like to think so, but, you know, I've actually seen some younger guys who are pretty resistant to the idea, too. I guess that sort of meatball, like, you know, you can't measure everything thing, you know, attitude is still kind of out there, especially among a certain faction of fans and of people who do reporting. But I think that, you know, most people by this point, I would say, have, I hope, embraced analytics. There's a lot of older white dudes running around out there in media.
Yeah, I didn't want to come on saying that. But
whether it's, you know, talking about not being, you know, on board with the analytics, or whether it's the just the casual sexism that comes out of their mouths 24 hours a day, pretty much, or, you know, it's something that's going to have to change. Like I said, I feel like I love Cubs Twitter so much, and I love all the baseball Twitters so much, because I feel like it's so much younger, it's so diverse, it's so much more progressive in terms of what, you know, people will look at and accept and theories and stuff like that. And you know, when I was getting blasted by someone who shall remain nameless in the media for what I said about Jason Hayward, I was getting tons of DMs from people I really respect in the industry who were saying, you know, just, you know, keep fighting your fight. You're saying all the right things. You're right, you know. And I think that there is just a fundamental difference between sort of like this generation and the one before us. And I think that, you know, as that era starts to sort of retire and go away, that things are going to change.
And Julie, we had Sarah Spain on the podcast about, what was it, 4 weeks ago? And it was right before the video came out that you and her were on. Mm-hmm. And I've been curious to I mean, I saw some of the reactions from people, and I, you know, we talked about it a little bit, but I'm curious what kind of reactions people have given you after seeing that video.
I would say it was 90% positive reaction. It definitely brought out trolls, which I think we expected. I actually thought it brought out less trolls probably than I thought. I thought it would be closer to like 50-50, but it really wasn't. It was more like 90-10, which was extremely encouraging. You know, the thing is, you know, it's sort of, because it increased my profile, it opened me up to a whole new level of abuse that I hadn't experienced before. But, you know, it's one of those things that I guess you just, you know, sort of have to deal with it and fight your way through it. And, you know, try to figure out how to coexist with a Twitter account that is, you know, terrifying sometimes. But, yeah, I mean, I think that Sarah and I would both say that we got a much bigger positive reaction than we probably expected.
Julie, I mean,
that
you
makes
and
me
I...
happy.
Yeah, it made me happy, too.
You and I have interacted on Twitter, I think, going back quite a while. And, you know, when I was watching the video for the first time, a lot of the things that the guys were reading to you, I immediately remembered from, you know, instances where, you know, you were talking about it and, you know, all that. And so I'm kind of watching along going like, yeah, I remember that. And I'm watching the faces on these guys who probably had no idea what they were in for and maybe didn't know who you guys were. And I'm seeing like a lot of pain on their faces, and I'm seeing a lot of pain on your face. were you feeling at that time watching them, like, a lot of empathy for what they were going through, having to read that to you? Or what was the feeling in that moment for
you?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, first of all, I mean, I'd read these a million times because I had screen capped them. I'd gone back through them and pulled them out for the guys who produced the video, the guys at Just Not Sports. And then, you know, I had had it read to me. We were working with a field of maybe like 25 tweets. So they were coming up. There were maybe like, you know, 15 guys that are maybe more that I worked with. So I was hearing him over and over and over by that point. You know, at a certain point, you just become numb to the whole thing. It's just like, whatever, you know, okay, call me fat, call me ugly, call me a whore, tell me you want me to get raped, whatever. I've heard it all before. But watching them go through it was really hard because they were such good guys. And they were so, when they found out, you know, they didn't find out until afterwards what they were doing. You can see their faces as the whole thing's like going south and they just really don't know what to do or say. But afterwards, when we told them what we were doing, they were also on board. Some of them stayed to watch other guys do it. Still in touch with a lot of them, even though I'd never met them before that day. So, you know, it was very tough to watch them go through it. I wanted to let them off the hook, some of them, and just say, look, I've heard this 10 times today. It's fine. You can say it to me. But that would sort of defeat the purpose. So, yeah, it was tough. I mean, it was, you know, I think we all have certain things we don't like about ourselves or certain things that we wish were better about about us. And so trolls seem to often be able to really find just that sweet spot to really, really hurt your feelings. So, you know, I hear a lot of people say, like, oh, it doesn't even faze me anymore. I hope I never get to the point where it doesn't faze me because, you know, when someone hurts your feelings, it hurts your feelings. You're human. You don't want to become, you know, like an ice queen where just, you know, no one can say anything to you that bothers you. But I think that you do sort of get to a certain level of numbness where it's just, you know, after a while, it's all right, fine, whatever. I've heard it all before.
Cubs lose. Well, I just saw the Cubs just lost the game. It just ended now. So hot off the presses, even though everybody's listening to this tomorrow.
That's a downer. Cubs get shut out.
Way to bring us down, Carlos.
That's usually Joel's job, Julie. Just
glad to not have to wear that mantle tonight.
He's the old white guy that depresses right, us. Right.
He's the resident power and the resident dick joke.
That's wow. Right. Yeah, I'll have to stick around for that.
Yeah, well,
To come back to the Cubs a little bit, two podcasts. Just to go back to the Cubs a little bit, Julie. I'm curious, what, you know, obviously the Cubs are off to a great start, this rough patch notwithstanding. But have there been any surprises or anything that you didn't expect from this team that we're seeing that you've kind of like focused on or zeroed in on?
Yeah, I was a little iffy about Jason Hamels coming into this season. You know, I know he was injured last year. I know he had a hamstring issue going on. I really didn't know what to expect from him. I really didn't expect him to pitch as well as he has. Kyle Hendricks, I think, has been a pleasant surprise. I think we all knew that he was, you know, on that, you know, arrow was trending upward with him. But tonight, you know, he allowed one run. He's been really good his last couple times out. So that, to me, has been pleasantly surprising because the pitching staff was where I was most concerned, especially the starting rotation going into the year. So that was, you know, that was good. And then Dexter Fowler being able to come back and repeat and even improve on what he did last year, I don't know that anybody really expected that to happen. You know, last year was sort of a career year for him, and I didn't know when he was coming back what exactly was going to happen this year. And, you know, and the other thing, too, is I think, you know, I could say thinking about John Lackey, like I was very surprised with how well he's pitched this year because I did not expect that from him. I looked at last year as sort of an outlier, you know, and thought that maybe he, you know, would regress a little bit this year, but he's really been very, very good.
You know, Julie, I'm wondering if you look at the team now. I mean, I'm just kind of assuming that they're going to straighten the ship a little bit after this little bit of a rough patch. And you had to say something you really think they need to improve. You know, they're obviously they still have the best record in baseball, but what do you think that they should do to take the next step, if there is such a thing?
Yeah, I think they got to get Jason Hayward going. I think his swing just looks completely crazy to me. It, you know, one day it looks really kind of loopy and long, and then the next day it looks almost too compact. Like, he just sort of looks like he really has no idea what he wants his swing to look like right now or what his swing should look like. So that's I think, an issue. I don't know. There's not a ton to complain about with this team, really. I think that they're playing really tough teams, and the Giants have been red hot. I don't really know what the issue is with the sub-500 teams like the Padres and the Brewers. I don't know if it's sort of looking past them or if it, you know, they seem to, and you know, the other day I got a bunch of grief too for saying that, you know, they always make bad pitchers look great. And I wasn't necessarily talking about this year. It's just like the past like 10 years, it feels like, you know, they play guys like Kershaw and, you know, and Zach Greinke really well. And then it comes like some no name that we've never heard of. And that's who they, you know, really struggle with. I don't know exactly what is going on there. If it's, you know, Joe Madden was talking the other day about he didn't know if it was cockiness or arrogance. And if that's an issue, then that's something that they definitely need to work on. But, you know, I feel like if they get, you know, Jason Hayward going and if everyone else just, you know, sort of settles into their roles, I really think they're going to be in great shape.
Well, Julie, we don't want to keep you too long because I know you have a very busy schedule with all the things you do. Thank you very much.
I'm very much in demand.
This is awesome. Thank you.
Yes. Quickly go ahead and please promote everything that you do and tell everyone where they can find you.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Julie DeCaro. You can find most of my writing at The Cauldron and at CBS and The Score website, although there are some new outlets I'll be writing for in the coming days. Twitter or my Facebook page is probably the best place to get hold of me.
Cool. Well, yeah, that's an excellent tease.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun. Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Julie.
Definitely. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so the Cubs lose again today. You know, I feel like week after week we've been saying, hey, Cubs, you know, go 5-2, go 7-0. Everything's great. Great, great, great. They're hitting a rough patch. We knew this was going to happen eventually. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, what can they do to just kind of, they know this is going to happen, just get through it, keep that, you know, great chemistry that they've had. What things, if anything, Joe Madden can do to try to kind of push the team through a rough patch like this. Is it a player thing? Is it a coach thing? What do you guys think, Ryan?
I think this is just an it happens to every team thing, and right now it just seems to be, you know, when they get really good pitching like they did tonight, Hendricks, you know, wasn't on top of his game necessarily, but only gave up one run. He did walk three and only walk run. He walked three and only struck out one. Stumbling over today, so it wasn't his best game. But they lost 1-0. They didn't score any runs. And granted, they're going up against Bumgarner, but you know, they scored 8 runs and only gave up one in the first game of the series. They scored 3 yesterday, but gave up 5. They scored 0 today and gave up 1. So it just seems like one of those stretches where, you know, nothing's really working all that well. Kind of counting it up, looks like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 losses in their last 11 games. That's a pretty prolonged stretch of just kind of mediocre bad, but we all know this team's talented. They're going to come out of it. I don't think they need to do anything too drastic right away.
You know what? It reminds me of the rough patch they had. I'm trying to remember exactly when it was, but it was on the earlier side of the summer last year where they just could not score a run. Remember that? And it was just painful. They were like, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? You didn't know how they were going to get just a couple runs across to win a game. And then eventually, you know, they busted out. Chris Bryant found his swing and everything was fine. But I think, like you said, knowing that this is going to happen and there's really nothing you can do other than just forget it and move on to the next game.
Yeah, you know, I revel in my role as the doom and gloom sayer. I'm not that worried. You know, I know that one of people will point at probably two players to say these guys are hurting us, and it was Hayward before he got injured. And to be honest, I know that, I mean, the thing that actually has given me solace is when Ryan pointed out his splits last year over the same period, and he said that they were basically the same, if not worse, last year compared to this year, and he still put up really good numbers over the, you know, by the end of the year, which made me think that, you know, he's due for an extended hot streak once he comes back. But, and then the other player would be Rizzo, because he's had a really rough stretch here the last several games. I think at one point I saw he was 1-for-20. I think I have that right. And But, you know, if you ask me one player on the team who doesn't worry me, it is probably him over anyone, over Arrieta, Lester, anyone. So I just feel like he's getting that, you know, when he connects and he hits that, you know, a long homer to right field and he connects and he's down on one leg, it looks great. But when he doesn't, it looks a little silly. So I think he just needs to kind of rein it in a little bit. He does, the last couple times I've seen him at the plate, he looks like he's pressing. He looks kind of fidgety and he's kind of, you know, there's just a lot more happening than I normally see with him. So, but, you know, the only thing that worries me a little bit is just losing to teams like the Padres and the Brewers. You know, and tonight they just ran into a buzzsaw. So, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, Carlos, I remember several weeks ago we were talking about what could go wrong with this team, and you said just baseball. And, you know, it's a long season, and, you know, by that you mean anything from extended losing streak to the, you know, near catastrophic injury that happened with Hayward. And I think that that's what we're seeing now. We're just seeing baseball happening. And there's nothing that really worries me. Ryan, you also wrote about how, you know, when the team, when the weather warms up, the team will probably warm up. So I'm, you know, they've built such a strong lead. They have so much credibility, obviously. I'm really not that worried.
One player that I'm looking at that does have me a bit concerned lately is Javier Baez. And I know we're talking about basically half the team slumping, but he had a 1-for-4 yesterday. He was 0-for-1 today. And then counting backwards, 0-for-4, 0-for-1, 0-for-2, 0-for-3, 0-for-3, 0-for-1, 0-for-1. He's in pretty
rough. Oh, God.
Yeah. He's in a pretty rough stretch right now, and he's very important to the team. I'm not talking about sending Javier Baez down or anything, but, you know, when a guy's in a slump like that and he's essentially a part-time player and he's 22, 23 years old, what can they do with him? Is this the downside of so many great players in a lineup that now that some of them are slumping, they can't work them out of it because they're not playing every day?
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I've noticed that he's struggled, and I also see Addison Russell. You know, I know that Isaac isn't here to leap through my computer screen and strangle me when I say this, but he's, you know, yeah. I'm looking at his numbers, 0-for-3, 0-for-1, 0-for-3, 1-for-6, 0-for-3, 1-for-3, 1-for-4, 1-for-4. So, you know, he's struggling too. I feel like everyone, you know, it's just hitting everyone at the same time, and I don't know what that is. Maybe they've been on the road for a little while. You know, they flew into San Francisco after playing in Milwaukee. You know, I don't know. I mean, Russell has a little bit more of a track record than Baez, so I just feel like it's probably a little bit of a slump kind of hitting everyone at one time. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, you had someone stepping forward and carrying the team, and that was Ben Zobrist. You know, and I was looking at, I'm like, oh, you know, hey, Jorge Soler's been playing pretty well. But before tonight, I'm like, yeah, he had that, you know, a homer, and he had that opposite field double last night. But then I looked at it over the last 10 games, he's batting 250, his slash is 250, 294, 438. So he's clearly not the the savior. So, I mean, we don't have to turn this into the Jorge Soler hour. But it just seems like there's been no one. The pitching has been pretty solid. Lester struggled a little bit last night, but you know, the hitting, just no one has been able to really take the team on their shoulders and carry them through this rough patch.
Well,
real quick on Russell, 0-for-4, 4 strikeouts tonight. Ooh, sorry, go ahead.
Golden sombrero.
Well, yeah. You're talking about, you know, having a savior step in and get the job done. We've got that person now, and his name is Matt Caesar. He's back on the team.
Yes.
I think we can all calm down. I did want to talk about, so with Matt Caesar coming back, they made this move, right, where they designated Neil Ramirez for assignment so that they could keep Tim Fedorovich. I'm never going to pronounce
close
it right.
Close enough.
So three catchers, which when the Cubs did this last season, I thought, okay, great. You got Wellington Castillo. You've got the other. It's our. I understood it somewhat. And then when it ended, when they traded him away, I realized, oh, that was not a good idea. Having three catchers sounded great in theory. What they plan to do this year with Kyle Schwarber, I thought that was a good idea, but I just do not see them keeping three catchers on the roster till the end of the season. I do not think that's going to happen. So this move in essentially losing Neil Ramirez, I understand that if there's an injury, you need to have somebody that can catch, that you trust, that can frame. I mean, basically, let's be honest, that's what they like about him, is his framing. And it just goes to show you again, and it's too bad Isaac isn't here yet, that they value framing this much, that they said, hey, guy who was awesome 2 years ago and might potentially still be there at some point, goodbye. We're keeping three catchers so that we can keep this backup guy. What do you guys think about this?
First of all, it makes me kind of wonder. They needed another bat, essentially, for Hayward, because Hayward's not going on the DL. Mm-hmm. And they were calling up Caesar either, you know, basically right away or within the next few days, because he was on a minor league assignment. So they needed to send somebody down. They'd already lost Ryan Kalish, or I don't know if they lost him yet or if they just put him on waivers to keep Tim Fedorovich before. Now they're putting Neil Ramirez out to keep him, and he hasn't really played, but at the same time, Miguel Montero, you know, David Ross started 2 days in a row. I mean, I know the first one was Lester and today was against a left-hander, a tough left-hander, but it just kind of makes me wonder what's going on with Montero. Is he still not 100%? And if he isn't, why did they rush him back when the team is, you know, at that time, 8 games up in the division? There's just a lot of questions. I don't necessarily say that letting go of Neil Ramirez was wrong. His velocity is still around what it was all last year and, you know, early this year. He's, you know, hitting 93, at most 94 on the fastball, whereas he used to sit around 95, 96, touch 97 back when he was dominating in 2014. I know his performance has been up and down lately. Yeah, he's walking guys. He's not controlling his pitch as well. I wrote something about him a while back where I essentially said, you know, he's got a wicked slider and a 93-mile-an-hour fastball. There is zero reason he can't turn himself into a quality middle reliever. So if he washes out his career because his fastball ticked down, that's on him not figuring it out more than it is his velocity issues. The comparison I made was Michael Wirtz. I would venture to say Ramirez's slider is at least as good, possibly better than Wirtz's was, and he's got a better fastball at this point, even with the velocity loss. So I was really interested to see if he could kind of reinvent himself a little bit this year and you know, use his slider more and, you know, figure things out, but he just couldn't. Maybe it was not being used in any kind of frequent manner or reasonable role, but he didn't look like he'd put it together, and at this point I just am not that surprised that they just cut bait.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it has less to do with Fedorovich. My initial reaction was like, really? Like, watch, in 3 weeks when they realize they can't carry three catchers, they're going to get rid of him, and then we're going to be looking for an arm. But maybe this is more of a, they feel so comfortable with that crazy amount of depth that they stocked up on in the offseason. Remember, we talked about that. I mean, they've got Spencer Patton at AAA, who I know he came up and was awful. I think his ERA is infinity in the major leagues, but he still has not allowed an earned run last time I checked at AAA. And Gerardo Concepcion, the Cuban guy who came with such fanfare back in, what was it, 2012, and essentially bombed. And he's been fantastic. He hasn't allowed an earned run at AA or AAA, and that's covering 23 innings. He's allowed 7 hits. So maybe they're just really comfortable with what they have down there, that they're like, you know what, we can afford to make this move.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a broken record here, but I kind of feel like, you know, Ramirez hasn't pitched that much this year, and he's not been overwhelming. And I feel like they probably have analytics well beyond anything our mortal minds can comprehend. And they're seeing something, you know. And how many moves have they made, you know, has Theo made, you know, that you've been like, oh, that, boy, that really wasn't a good move in retrospect. You know, maybe the Tyler Colvin, DJ LeMahieu move, but, you know, that's kind of about it. So I feel like, I mean, I don't know that I agree with it based on what I'm seeing at this point, but I feel like in a month we won't, this won't even occur to us. Like, we won't be thinking, oh, man, we let that guy go. Oh, crap. He's tearing it up. You know, I think that we're going to be like, oh, yeah, whatever. And we'll look at him as like a Michael Wirtz, like a guy who had a nice little run, but, you know, is gone and we're fine without it.
Well, you know what's funny? I just finished reading that book by Sam Miller and Ben Lindbergh. The only rule is it has to work, where they take over an independent league team, the Sonoma Stompers, and, you know, apply all kinds of sabermetric knowledge to the way that they acquire and run the team. And it was really interesting. It's a great, great book. But there's a chunk of it where they spend time talking about how, you know, they thought they were going to make these moves and based on this and based on that and all this shifting and blah, blah, blah. But then they realize that, you know, these are human beings. And one of the goals of this independent league is to just send guys up to a higher league. Like, that's basically the goal. Just like the goal in AA and AAA isn't necessarily to win, but it's to shoot people up to the big leagues, right, to create major leaguers. And it was very interesting hearing from their perspective, like, they didn't do all the things that they wanted to do, that they wanted to implement, because they realized, you know what, these are human beings, and we can't just go in here and apply it because we want to do it. I just thought that was a very interesting angle, and it's a, you know, talking about the humanity of the players in the game sometimes gets lost when we look at all the numbers, but I just, it was very interesting to hear, and I think about that a lot when I'm, you know, watching something going on with the Cubs on whether, oh, making this move, making that move. Neil Ramirez basically doesn't have a job right now, and sure, he's probably going to get one pretty soon, but just another thing to keep in mind.
That's a really good point, Carlos.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think that a lot of us look at these guys like, oh, well, they're multi-gazillionaires. It's like, well, Neil Ramirez probably went several years where he didn't make much money. He probably didn't make, I mean, I don't have his numbers in front of me, obviously, but he probably didn't make that much. And then if his career is over, then, you know, it's not like he can, you know, he's not going to be like, you know, Jake Arrieta coasting on, you know, tens of millions of dollars, or, you know, Jason Hayward or whoever, Steven Strasburg. Like, he is, you know, he might be like, you know, in a couple of years being like, well, I've always kind of liked real estate, so maybe I'll become a realtor. You know, it's funny to think that these guys are going to have to do something else, you know. So I wonder what that will be.
All right. Well, we've got a late joiner here. Isaac Bennett was not on the first half of the podcast, obviously. He was writing the recap for tonight's game, which the Cubs lost 1-0. So, Isaac, you want to fill us in on how the game went? Anything that stood out that you noticed today?
Not really. I guess.
Okay, well, let's move on to
I guess I'm used to being a late joiner. But, yeah, it's one of those games that Madison Bumgarner came out and did ace-like things, and it's, you kind of have to tip your cap to him and say, hey, you were awesome. In the very first inning, actually, the Cubs had three guys on, bases loaded, and Addison Russell was up, and I was getting my popcorn ready to watch Mr. Russell perform his duties as usual, and he came in slugging .548 with runners in scoring position this year, so he was the right man at the right time. I wrote that in my recap. And you had the righty against Bumgarner, the lefty, and Russell worked 8 pitches. It was 3-2. He'd fouled 3 off. It was pretty exciting. And then Bumgarner did what Bumgarner does and threw a laser at the knees somewhat on the corner and froze Russell. And the moral of the story after that was the Cubs do nothing because they didn't have another runner in scoring position all night long. So the good news is they only had one at bat where they didn't get a hit with a runner in scoring position. The bad news was is they only had one chance. So 0 for 1, which means they're 6 for their last 45 with runners in scoring position. That's the last 7 days, and that's pretty much been the story of the week so far.
Like the 2013 Cubs all of a sudden.
Oh, wow. Thanks, Joel.
Yeah. We were talking earlier before you jumped on about the specific struggles, and we talked about Javier Baez is one of them, and really you could list them all out. Addison Russell, 0 for 4, 4 strikeouts tonight. He's struggling lately. Rizzo struggling lately. What did you see? Anything from, you know, was there a specific play with Baez I heard? I didn't get to watch the second half of the game. What happened with him?
Yeah, and it was a controversial play, and Twitter is just burning right now from it. But Baez hit a kind of a chopper to the right side that Bumgarner fielded, and Baez was about halfway down the line, and he was actually running about a foot inside the line on the left side as he was coming from his right-handed place in the batter's box. And as Bumgarner chased him, he crossed over to the left side and kind of made an agile move, and Bumgarner swiped at him and missed as Baez kind of dove beneath his glove towards first base. He clearly missed, but Dana DeMuth, the first base umpire, immediately called him out, and you could hear him say, out of the baseline, he's out. And Baez kind of stood up and put his hands on his helmet like, oh, I don't think that's the right call. And Joe Maddon immediately came flying out of the dugout and was kind of screaming at DeMuth, and the field mics actually eventually picked it up, and Maddon was saying something to the effect of over and over, you're better than that, you're better than that, which is kind of the most insulting thing you can ever say to an umpire, which is, you know you're wrong and I know you're wrong, but you're better than that, so make it better next time. But the replay showed that Baez was only maybe 18 inches to the right of the baseline, and he was actually still in the runner's box. He made a great play, and his left hand actually came through and grabbed the bag as he dove, which kind of shows you how close to the baseline that he was. So it was a really bad call. I don't know that it really affected anything in the game because none of the hitters behind him did anything, but it was kind of a good moment to get some anger and frustration out.
Yeah, you know, it seems like a kind of a bummer of a game, clearly.
Low-hanging fruit.
Sometimes you just run into a buzzsaw, and that's what happened here with Bumgarner, and, you know, you can only do what you can do against a guy like that. But, you know, with the Brewers and the Padres, it's been a little bit of a bummer of a week and a half. So I'm going to do, we started a new segment last week called I Wonder, and basically what it is someone throws out a question to the other guys in the podcast, and so they don't know what the question is going to be, and you just kind of have to riff off it. So I'm going to, I'll go again this week because it's new and we're just kind of getting a feel for it, and I'm going to say, so I wonder what people should feel optimistic about. So what should the meatballs who are on the ledge, how would you talk them down? What would you say, Carlos, if you were on the bus next to some guys like, oh, yeah, the Cubs are obviously losing it there, pal. And I'm doing a bad Chicago accent. I can normally do it. It's just not happening. I don't know. I apologize. But anyway, if you were sitting on the bus next to a guy who said, yeah, you know what, this season's over. Clearly it's falling apart. What would you say to make him feel better?
I would say the team has the best record in baseball still, despite this slump. The pitching has been outstanding. Slumps happen. This is baseball. You did not expect this team to win, 140 games, whatever the equivalent would have been there. It's just, this is how it goes. Things go up, things go down. If this person were a NBA fan, I would say, you know, watch a basketball game, how quickly things, you know, turn, and they go one way, and then momentum swings, and this is what it is, but extended over 162 games. So calm down. And as you introduced this segment, I did have an I wonder question ready, and I wonder what Pete Lecoq is up to these days, really. It's kind of my big question.
What he's up to? Interesting. Yep. Phrasing.
No, I did it on purpose, Joel. Give me some credit.
Mm-hmm. Someday I will.
All the bum jokes we could make, and we're still going back to Lecoq.
This is so awesome.
All right. Well, to bring it back around, I'll answer Joel's question. my response is pretty similar to Carlos, which I think he just hit the nail on the head for the most part. It's all about ebbs and flows. And the one thing that I could say we might have been more, we probably could have seen coming this whole thing if we had noticed they're winning a lot of games by a lot of runs early on, and they had a lot of guys going all at once where they were winning 8-1, you know, 10-2, whatever. So when everybody's on at once, it makes sense that a slump that follows would be everybody off at once, and that's really what they're going through right now. So they just need to get back to where they have two or three guys going really well at any given time, and if that happens like it does with most teams, I think they're going to be just fine. So this is a temporary thing going on, and just got to hope that they have it all turned around by the time they go to play St. Louis.
Yeah, and I would say echoes of the same sentiments, really. It struck me tonight watching the ESPN broadcast, which I actually had unmuted tonight for the first time in a while since I had to recap it. It struck me tonight that they were talking about how good the Giants had been and how great Jeff Samardzija had been and Johnny Cueto had been, and obviously Bumgarner has been great. The Giants were 7 games over 500 coming into tonight, and the Cubs were 17 games over 500. So exiting tonight, the Cubs are 16 games over 500, and the Giants are 8 over. So if you can't find optimism in this team right now, stop following baseball, because they're the best team in baseball. They've been dominant. They've still been dominant. It's been one rough week where the Cubs have gone 6-45 with runners in scoring position, which is a complete aberration and no indication of their actual skill level in those situations. So the runs will come back. They've had a ton of base runners. They just need to knock them around, and you can't take anything more from this week than it's baseball.
And Matt Caesar's back.
Yeah.
Isaac's favorite player.
You know what's funny is during the game tonight, Matt Caesar came in on a little horrible little Joe Panic classic dumper right into right field, and he made a nice diving effort at it, and it kind of short hopped up and hit him in the face. And I was writing at the time, and I looked up and I made the comment, oh, that just hit Bryant in the face, and then looked back down and started writing again, and then looked back up at the TV and realized it was actually Caesar in right field and not Bryant. And my wife was sitting there, and I said, oh, that's actually Caesar, not Bryant. And immediately my mind went to Joel Rees thinking, all the handsomeness.
Right? It's too much handsomeness. My screen, I blew out my my monitor, just went. It's just, I didn't have my handsome filter on.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be
another dose. Yeah.
A ball hitting him right in his moneymaker.
There's another dose of positivity. And actually, you know, my wife also said yesterday, she said, you know, I won't be happy for you, speaking to me, I won't be happy for you if the Cubs win the World Series, she pauses and then says, unless Jake Arrieta pitches the winning game, and then, you know, I just think he deserves it. He's so awesome and so good-looking.
I won't be happy for you, my husband, who has been following this team your whole life, putting your emotions into this, but I will be happy if it's Jake Arrieta, a man I've never met, on the mound.
Yes, the irony was not lost on me.
That's a good deconstruction of that situation. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think she was completely serious, too. I don't think it was a joke.
She's a Cardinals fan. Of course she would. I mean, I don't know your wife, but yeah, no, I would assume if she's a Cardinals fan, she's not going to be happy for you if the Cubs win the World Series.
Yeah, no, she's not, and that's, you know, why right before I walked down the aisle, and this isn't a joke, I think I've told this story, but right before I walked down the aisle, my brother grabbed my arm, my oldest brother, and he said, are you sure that you can do this? And he was completely serious.
See, if it were me, I don't know if you had like a Catholic style wedding, but if you had them kneeling, you could have put Go Cubs on the bottom of your shoes.
That's a good touch.
Yeah.
You've thought of it all, Ryan.
I know.
I'm curious if the listeners are in a positive, optimistic frame of mind or if they're going all Joel Rees on us. So any sense of that from the question of the week this week, Ryan?
Well, I'll just jump right into the question of the week, which was, what's it going to take to move Hayward down in the order? So if that tells you how positive the thinking is, the wording itself lends to the idea that this specific listener at EL Harmon Z on Twitter.
There's no 69 in there.
No.
Or 420, I don't know.
There should be, though. This specific person already seems to think that Hayward should have been moved down a while ago. I can't say I necessarily disagree, but I'll throw that out to the group. What do you guys think? And is there a specific event that it would need to happen to move Hayward down? Is it just a continued struggle for a long time? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I've thought about this a lot, and I go back and forth on it. I can see the arguments for it, and I can see the arguments against it. Just that, you know, what do you kind of throw the lineup into some chaos, and everyone's struggling now, so it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to kind of upset the apple cart for him. But it is so frustrating. I have to say. I mean, maybe I know you guys are better at taking. You're better taking the long term than I am, and I know I tend to look on the darker side, but I see him just grounding out to the second baseman time and time again, and I know his numbers are decent, but it drives me mad to just watch him, you know, strike out or ground out again and again. And I know that the numbers say he's going to turn around, and I'm trying to take the long term perspective on that, and I'm sure that eventually we'll look back on this period and laugh, but man, it is really frustrating to watch him, you know, assuming he comes back. And to be honest, this injury, I've read a fair amount of people say that they feel like he doesn't, you know, if he's got a problem with his wrist, and Julie was saying it earlier, that his swing just doesn't look right. So maybe a little time healing, maybe a little time off wouldn't be the worst thing. But because for me personally, I just find it really frustrating to watch him. So I don't think it's probably the right thing to make some sort of rash move as far as the lineup, but I do find it very exasperating to watch him repeatedly just ground out again and again.
I would say nothing. Don't move him. If he's doing badly, get it out of the system sooner by giving him more at-bats. And this is a guy that they spent a ton of money on. He's not going anywhere. Just keep playing him where he's at and stop complaining. Sorry.
I think I'm with Carlos on this one. Ryan, you covered a couple weeks ago what he had done historically in April and May, and basically he just gets better and better as the season goes on. I mean, his Aprils, he's a 225, 318, 387 hitter, and if you jump down to, say, August, he's a 301, 369, 504 hitter. So year after year after year, he starts slow for whatever reason. I'm not sure anybody can really diagnose why, but I think we're probably just about to get into a spot where Jason Hayward hits really well and deserves that second spot in the order. So we started to see it a little bit last week, even though the contact was still pretty soft. A lot of them were falling in for hits, and I think that'll come back around. But when he gets back in there from his couple days off here, I think you put him right back in the two hole.
I agree with that, and I guess my final thought on the whole thing is I was making the case a while back that maybe you move him down and move Addison Russell up in the lineup a little bit, but he's gone back to struggling a little bit too. So I guess at this point, put him back in where he goes, and maybe we talk about this again if he continues to struggle in, you know, let's say late June or early July.
I would be amenable to that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, Joel, I'm going to try to give you another opportunity at doing something positive rather than something negative. 60 seconds, this is where you shine.
Pressure's on.
Yep, it is. So what do you got today?
I'm going to do Corey Patterson.
I will have to say this is one of the players that I have obsessed with more than any other in my entire life, because of the fact that he could have been one of the greatest. But that being
he had it all, but it just didn't happen. But here we go.
Ready?
Yep.
Go.
Before Corey Patterson arrived at Wrigley Field, we Cubs fans heard about the minor league phenom for years. Like Hesab Choi and Brooks Kieschnick before him, the exasperating Patterson, one of those players Phil Rogers wrote about who was destined for greatness. Thus frustrating as F, Patterson started to put it together in 2003. In 83 games, he had 55 RBIs and 16 stolen bases for a solid 2.5 WAR, but he blew out his knee hitting first base at a bad angle, which was the kind of injury Cubs players used to incur back then, and he was done for the year. There's every reason to think that maddening Patterson was destined for greatness in 2004, but he went from Devon White to Rob Deere, striking out in 25% of his at-bats. After three more years of maddening mediocrity, the Cubs traded Patterson to the Orioles for a bag of Funyuns and a six-pack of Mr. Pibb. Incredibly, Patterson played four more years, landing on the St. Louis Cardinals for part of their infuriating 2011 World Series winning season. I looked to see if he got a World Series ring, but the vexatious Patterson made me too mad, so I got drunk and stopped. The bottom line was, it's hard to kind of capture that in the 60 seconds, but that guy was so frustrating. I mean, he was like, I just remember, like, at a certain point he decided he was going to become a masher. And so he would just swing for the fences all the time. And sometimes he would connect. But other times, I remember seeing him coming up with, like, bases loaded, nobody out, and he would swing from the back of his heels. And he'd strike out, and he'd walk back to the bench like, you know, what can you do? And I remember I looked for a quote. I spent literally like half an hour looking for a quote because I remember reading at one point he says something about like, well, that's the kind of player I am. I'm not going to change the way I am. And it's like, you have to change who you are. If he had such speed. If he tried to use his speed, he could have been, you know, or there was, it just, he had all the tools, but for some reason he just couldn't quite put them together, and it was so frustrating.
There are two specific memories that I have of Patterson that stand out. The first one was in spring training 2003, after he'd had a pretty bad season in 2002,
yeah,
his first full season in the majors. He was being interviewed, and it was either he or Dusty Baker. And the let-on was that Patterson had implored Dusty Baker to bat him third in the lineup. And, I mean, however you want to say is the smart way to construct a lineup. Back then, Sammy Sosa was entrenched third in the lineup for years. And that just really grabbed me at the time, thinking, man, I mean, he's supposed to be great, but he's had an awful year. He hasn't put it together yet. And Sosa is mashing the ball batting third. Who is this kid coming in saying he wants to bat third in the lineup? The second memory was after they had sent him down in 2005. They called him back up after he went to AAA and supposedly figured out some things. His very first at bat, he laid down a bunt down the third baseline and bunted for a base hit, and he got a standing ovation at Wrigley Field. That was a moment where I thought maybe he had actually decided to change the way he played, kind of like the way you talked about, Joel. But unfortunately, from there, it was not in the cards.
Yeah. Carlos, you said you obsessed about him. What was your take on him?
The reason why I was so obsessed with him is because I always wondered, to this day I wonder, and maybe I'll try to find out the answer, did anyone ever pull him aside and say, Corey, you could be one of the greatest players this game has ever seen, but you need to do, you just need to work on one thing, and that's figuring out when a ball is a strike, when a pitch is a strike, and when it's a ball, and swing mostly at the strikes, okay? Whether that means getting into those machines that throw tennis balls at 120 miles an hour, or going to see an ophthalmologist, or going to see a shrink, or doing something, I don't know, starting to worship at the feet of Jobu, something. It's the one tool you needed to fix, and if he could have fixed that, man, the world was wide open for him to just be a gold glove caliber center fielder, outfielder that could do everything. But it never happened, I don't think. Or maybe it did, and he didn't have it in him to pick up that one skill that he was missing.
Yeah, I kind of have one memory and then two thoughts. The memory that I have is, I think on opening day 2002, if I'm remembering correctly, the Cubs won like 13-6, and I think Patterson had six RBIs, including three or four hits and a triple, and it was really exciting, and you felt like that the Cubs might be a decent team, and they might have a superstar on their hands to pair with Sosa and Alou, and it really felt like they were going to be a 3-4-5 that could be contended with for a long time, and it certainly didn't play out that way, but at the very least, I think we can take solace in the fact that maybe the Patterson trade to the Orioles for, what did you call it, a bag of balls and something else?
Mr. Pibb. A bag of Funyuns and a six-pack of Mr. Pibb.
Funyuns.
Diet Mr. Pibb.
Maybe that, Mr.
Pibb. They like that.
Maybe that just kind of greased the phone wheels, you know, for the eventual pillaging that, you know, a future front office would do with the Orioles. I don't know. It's just a theory.
Oh, that's a good point. So Corey Patterson begat Jake Arrieta.
Yeah,
actually,
maybe.
There's a middleman in there, too. The Cubs dealt, you know, future geriatric ace Rich Hill to the Orioles back in 2008 or early 2009 and basically sent him for, you know, what, the same kind of diet Mr. Pibb package that they got for Patterson.
Yep.
And then, you know, 10 years later or 8 years later, there he is back in the major leagues.
That's what we call the slow play. I like it.
Yeah.
But the last thing on Patterson, guys, and I think this is an overlooked part of this story, is that in 2001, Corey Patterson had just turned 21, and he was playing in his first stint in AAA. He had basically started at A-ball at the age of 19 and then gone to AA the next year and played 118 games there. And then in 2001, he was not even 21 when he started, so he's still very young. He played 89 games there. You go look at his slash line in Iowa in the PCL, a very hitter-friendly league. He slugged .387 and had a .308 on base in his time in Iowa for a .694 OPS. Does that sound like a guy that needs to be called up to the major leagues to play center field? I just, in today's day and age, I think it would be unheard of to call up a player that was OPSing .694 for his debut at the tender age of 21. It sounds like Corey Patterson could have used another year or maybe 2 years in AAA to try and figure out his issues with picking up spin and understanding the strike zone. So maybe they did some irreparable damage when they called him up.
Yeah, I think they did, and I think it speaks to two things, and this is going back to my memories of build my first memories as a Cubs fan. He actually got called up for the first time in 2000, which I think a lot of people don't know. He came up for a very short stint, I think, when Sammy Sosa was on the DL for a short period of time in 2000.
11 games, yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't play particularly well. He was, I want to say, 20. I don't think he had played at AAA yet, had he?
No.
I mean, I think at that point, the Cubs were desperate to bring up a star player, and they were overlooking the development period, and that was just the way they did their business. In 2001, I firmly believe that that was a part of it too, but it also was that late in the season or in the middle of the season, whenever he came up, they were struggling to score runs, and they had jumped out to a lead in the division, and they were trying like hell to keep that lead and keep that team in contention, and it just did not work. And they ended up, I want to say, 5 games out in the division, but they were trying to do anything they could to repair that, and they had started the season with Damon Buford in center field. They ended up releasing him early on because he was so terrible, and they had Gary Matthews Jr. in center field, and the bat wasn't there yet, but the glove was there, and then they ended up putting him on waivers, which was idiotic, and they needed a center fielder, and I think that was just a desperation move that they had Patterson down there hiding at AAA, and they thought, if we bring him up, maybe he, you know, gives us a month and a half, 2 months of something, and we run into the playoffs and win the World Series, and, you know, who knows, but I remember that pretty vividly as what I felt like was a big desperation play.
That's a series of terrible moves, and you laid it out really well. And he played 11 games in 2000, and he OPS'd .572. And like you said, he hadn't had any time at AAA. And then the next year in AAA, he didn't fare much better. So It just has you here wondering, like, who's making the decisions? Who's pulling these strings? And I think you hit it on the head when you said that they were looking for a star player kind of to come up and play alongside Sosa. And it just tremendously backfired. And it's pretty unfortunate for Patterson, too, because I think they probably did him a disservice.
Yeah, absolutely. If he had been with a different organization, I mean, let's just say the Yankees. Let's say he had come up with the Yankees. That guy is probably, maybe he's not one of the best players to ever play. I mean, he had his issues, but that guy's a multiple-time All-Star, at least.
Yeah, I agree.
It's almost as if they would have, if the current Cubs administration would have brought up Al Mora like last year,
when he
was going through his struggles. Yeah,
that's a great comparison. That's actually who I was thinking of as I was going through it. It's like, if you bring Al Mora up last year for 11 games before he even has a chance in AAA, which is exactly what they did, he's going to be terrible in the majors. Mm-hmm. And then it's like if they had brought him up this year in the middle of April or maybe towards the end of April when he was struggling, you know, before he turned it on, he's been fairly consistent. But it just wouldn't make one lick of sense, and that's very synonymous to what they did with Patterson.
So Joel, to the guy on the bus that's like, oh, the bro who's like all pessimistic, that's another thing. Hey, you know, not that this administration would make a silly move like that, but it's another thing to hang your hat on. The team is so good and there's so much talent that nobody's reaching into AA to grab anybody that isn't ready.
Yeah, that may be a little beyond him. Is he like AA? What do you mean?
All right, so I think it's time to move on to the Addison Russell of the week. I mean, the at-bat of the week, Isaac.
Yeah, unfortunately, Russell is scuffling, and his chances this week didn't go so well. So for the second week in a row, we have the at-bat of the week is being betrayed, and it's going to be another plate appearance of the week. And what was so interesting about this situation is that Travis Wood not only starred in the bottom of the 12th inning, but also the top of the 13th inning on Wednesday night. I was watching that game, and I had planned to go to bed in about the 6th inning. It had been a very long day, and it was tied, and the Cubs scored in the top of the 9th. It was 1-0. I couldn't pull myself away from the game. They tied it in the 9th. I thought, okay, I'll just make sure they get out of the 9th, and then I'll go to bed. I didn't go to the bed until the top of the 12th inning when the Cubs didn't score. I went to bed. I was following on my phone. I followed on my phone until it became the bases loaded and nobody out for the Brewers in the bottom of the 12th, and Travis Wood was in the game. He had inherited two base runners, I think from Strope. And Travis Wood came in and he allowed one guy on. I think he walked him. And I fell asleep. I fell asleep with the bases loaded. So I woke up about, 30 seconds later, and I saw he got a pop-out. And I thought, I wonder why he didn't score on that pop-out. I fell back asleep and woke up about 15 minutes later, and all I saw was 2-1. And my brain, being, mostly asleep, the first thing it thought was, the Cubs lost 2-1. And then I realized that there were still guys on base, and immediately it clicked that the Cubs must have scored, because otherwise the game would be over. And it's the middle of the night. My wife's been in bed for 2 hours, and I let out a little yelp. I'm not going to go like, who was it, Howard Dean, on this podcast, but I let out a yelp that she jumped and turned around and looked at me like, there was somebody else in our bedroom or something. And I quickly made sure everything was okay and looked back down. And sure enough, the Cubs had gone ahead 2-1, but the way in which they did it was about as improbable as you could possibly get. As Travis Wood had worked out of the bases loaded, nobody out jam in the bottom of the 12th, he actually came up with the bases loaded in the top of the 13th. And after swinging at a strike, he took four consecutive pitches for ball four and forced in what would eventually be the game-winning run in 13 innings. The Cubs won 2-1. Travis Wood, the at-bat / plate appearance of the week.
Walks as good as a hit, right?
In this situation, I guess so.
Just another way to clog the bases.
Jerk, Travis Wood.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it's kind of interesting that Wood, he obviously pitches out of the tremendous jam, and then he creates pretty much the only offense for the Cubs, drawing the walk and forcing the run. And then a few days later, Madison Bumgarner comes back and does the exact same thing to the Cubs, completely shutting them down and delivering the only RBI of the day with his RBI double tonight. So it was a little bit of payback for the Cubs tonight.
Well, let's hope the Cubs pick it up here coming into the new week and facing the Cardinals. Maybe that'll give them a little spark to fire them up and start playing a little bit better.
That would be nice.
I would love to see better baseball, though. That in general would be good.
Yes.
Maybe even Joel will be optimistic next week.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's not go crazy here.
Yeah, let's one step at a time.
Yeah, baby steps.
All right, guys. It's been a good one.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll talk to you guys next week. Hopefully more victories.
That's right.
That's the goal. Win games.
Thanks to all our listeners.
Thanks.
Take care.
All right, bye.